Well, when we left the story the last time, the five Pandava brothers had been born in the forest, and Duryodhana had been born in Hastinapura. But then, unfortunately, Pandu disregarded the curse of the rishi, and as he took his wife in his arms, Madri, the curse was fulfilled, and he died. And so all of a sudden, Madri felt that she had caused his death, so when Pandu went on to the funeral pyre, she went onto the pyre with him. Kunti was left with the five boys, and she didn't know what to do, this we were describing at the end, so she went to the rishis, and they advised, well, it's time now for you to go back to Hastinapura. That's where you came. The only reason you're out in this forest is because Pandu was under this curse. Otherwise, these are princes, and they should be raised in a princely way. And so I just wanted you to get a picture in your mind of these five Pandava brothers, and also their arch enemy, Duryodhana, because they are the characters, the main characters of the story. Now, everything until now was just to give you an idea of the context of how they were born and why the interplay of these personalities, they're all that's behind it. So the five Pandavas, the oldest Pandava is Yudhishthira. And Yudhishthira, as you recall, was conceived between Kunti and the Lord of Dharma, also the Lord of Death. And he is considered, his quality is considered great calmness in the face of psychological battle. And you see throughout the whole story, Yudhishthira represents this ability not to get drawn into what's going on around him. He responds to it, he relates to it appropriately, but he has this centeredness that allows him to do what is right, to follow his father's way, which is Dharma, rather than to get sucked into the battle. It's an extraordinary example. And from time to time, he too is overcome. But nonetheless, that's his fundamental quality. The next son is Bhima. And Bhima is, Yudhishthira represents the throat chakra, and Bhima represents the heart chakra, and he's the great vitality, the force of our energy, the force of energy in a righteous cause is what Bhima represents. And he's big, and he's strong, and he's, because he's the heart chakra, he's very affectionate, and very loving, very outgoing in what he does. And also, it's the force of that vitality in a righteous cause that makes Bhima fundamental to the success of the war. And so Bhima's the warrior that we really rely upon, because if the heart is in it, then there's great power behind that. Then, and his father was the god of the wind. And it's also, his father is the same as the father of Hanuman, the monkey devotee who's the hero of the Ramayana, so there's this kind of a little overlap in this. And of course, the god of the wind represents the breath and the heart and the breath and the power of vitality and the prana. All these little images come together. Arjuna is the third son, and Arjuna's father is Indra, who's the king of the gods in the heavens. And Arjuna represents the third chakra, and he's the power of will and the power of fiery self-control. And Arjuna is the one who absolutely must be in the battle, or the forces of good have no chance of winning. And from the point of view of the chakras, when we speak of that, the third chakra represents our willpower, and whichever way our willpower goes, if it goes downward into the material plane, then it pulls our higher nature down with it. If it goes upward into spiritual aspiration, then all of our more materialistic tendencies are drawn upward. So whichever way Arjuna goes is the way the battle goes. And then the next brother is Nakula and Sahadev, the twins, and they are the lower two chakras, and they represent the yamas and the niyamas, the power to stay away from evil, the power to follow good rules. And their father is the Asvin twins, so that's why they're born as twins. And their mother was Madri, and she's the wife, the second wife of Pandu, the one who went on to the cremation pyre with him. And so in a sense, in technically speaking, they're half-brothers to the others, but that from time to time that comes out in the story, but their loyalty is absolute. The fact that they have different mothers is sometimes they try to use that to divide the brothers, never successfully, but that's part of the issue. And then with Dhritarashtra back in Hastinapura, while these divine, semi-mortal, half-mortal, half-divine beings are being born in the forest, on the same day that Bhima was born, Dhritarashtra had his first son, Duryodhana. And the omens, as I mentioned before, when Duryodhana were born, were very, very bad. And he was advised to put this child to death because he was going to cause the death of so many others. Because Duryodhana represents material desire. And when material desire runs amok, it causes the destruction of everything else because we lose our sense of nobility, our sense of higher purpose, our centeredness. It has the power to really take us off course. And so that was why Duryodhana's father was advised, you know, just get rid of this while it's small. And it was also advice saying, you know, get rid of the desire when it's small. Drown it while you still have control over it. Because if you train it and let it grow up and get really strong, then you have a force that you can't control anymore. Now, Duryodhana, you see, is the same age as Bhima, but he's also younger than Yudhishthira. So in his own household, Duryodhana is the firstborn. But once the Pandavas join the ranks, then he becomes the secondborn, and he's no longer the heir. So now Kunti takes her five sons back to Hastinapura, and they haven't been there in 16 years, so they know of them, but nobody knows them. So they're escorted by all the Rishis who's been raising them in the forest, and Kunti herself is magnificent, and these five young men are so extraordinary in their dynamism and their beauty that as they come into the town, really the citizens just come out on the street to see them, and they're so amazed. And Dhritarashtra and Bhishma and Ambika and Ambalika, who are the parents, the mothers of Pandu and his brother, and of Dhritarashtra. And Satyavati, who is Bhishma's mother and who's been the cause of this all, they're all there to greet them. And they're just grief-stricken to hear what's happened to Pandu. Satyavati had all these thoughts about her sons and how it would all work out. And now her other son is gone and there's just nothing that can be done. And they arrange for a royal ceremony and a mourning and so on. And Vyasa comes to preside at the ceremony. And of course, Vyasa is Satyavati's son. And after the funeral is over, he goes to Satyavati and he said, "Listen, mother, you think it's bad now. It's only going to get worse. You have no idea what a terrible cataclysm is coming." And he says to her, "You really don't want to be here to see it. Why don't you just take the opportunity now and go off to the forest?" And this is a wonderful tradition that comes through these epics that is a tradition in India, which in our Western way of thinking, we have so much greed for life, so to speak, and so much material definition that we just try to hold on to the world that we've got for as long as we possibly can. Whereas there's this wonderful tradition in India that when you have finished your duties in the world and you begin to see that the end of your life is coming, you get ready for it. And you renounce what's going to renounce you pretty soon anyway. And you just go off and live in the forest and meditate and attune yourself to a more refined vibration so that when you transition out of your body, you're ready to do it. So Satyavati, Ambika, and Ambalika all make plans to just go away to the forest. They have really had it, and they just don't really want to see it anymore. Bhishma hears of their plans and decides that he wants to go too. He has no interest in watching this whole thing. And his mother says to him that you can't possibly go. And Bhishma says, "Well, you're getting to leave with this cataclysm coming. Why not me?" She says, "You have a duty. You must raise these sons. This is why you were born." And once again, Bhishma is bound by this woman, Satyavati, his mother, who's been nothing but a trial to him in a sense. Not his mother, but his father's wife, his stepmother. And Bhishma says that he wants to give up his body, but Satyavati says, no, he can't. So he's compelled by fate. So now the five Pandavas begin their life as royal princes in this wealthy court. Until now, they've lived in the forest, but now they have to be trained for a very, very different life. And the Kauravas, which is Duryodhana and all his brothers, according to the story, there are 101 of them, they have to suddenly share with these cousins. Whereas before, the whole place belonged to them. Now these five very powerful and charismatic young men have come and demanding their place. And it's especially irksome to Duryodhana because he has Yudhishthira, who's older than him, and Bhima, who's the same age. And age and priority, of course, in a royal household are very important. So Duryodhana has now been greatly demoted, and he's very, very distressed about it. And Bhima has this enormous vitality, and he just doesn't hesitate to use it. His heart energy is loving and kind, but he's also a little bit out of control. And he and Duryodhana are similarly matched, and they often conflict. And Bhima tends to have the upper hand, and he lords it over Duryodhana. He doesn't have any sense of humility or sensitivity about it, and he bests Duryodhana, and then he gloats over his victories, and Duryodhana begins to develop a fierce resentment, a particularly fierce and intense resentment of Bhima. You know, what you have here is you have this vitality which represents the life force, and Duryodhana wants to draw that life force into material desire, and Bhima wants to use that life force to fight for righteousness and a good cause. So they're natural enemies. Bhima's the energy is committed upward, and Duryodhana wants to draw the energy downward, so he feels he has to eliminate that power of Bhima in order for him to have sway. So he develops a plot by which he's going to kill Duryodhana. And the whole family, all the cousins, go out by the river, and they have a picnic, and they have a day of games, and you know, it's a glorious sort of happy day out in the countryside. And Duryodhana is being the soul of graciousness and generosity, and even so he invites Bhima, come to my tent, I've prepared a special meal for you. He's acting as if, you know, all is forgotten, let's be friends. So he invites Bhima to his tent, and he serves him this special meal. But the meal has been very carefully prepared because it's laced with poison. And when the poison begins to take effect and Bhima goes unconscious from the effect of it in his system, Duryodhana and his cohorts bind Bhima up with vines, and they take him to a place in the river where they've planted sharp spikes. I mean, they're just making sure of everything. And they take the tied up Bhima, unconscious, throw him into the river, hoping to impale him on the spikes, and then they go back innocently to their quarters. Now, as it happens, of course, because this is a fable as well as a story, Bhima, even though he's tied up, managed miraculously to miss the spikes in the river. And he lands in a place, however, where there are many, many poisonous snakes. Now, Duryodhana knew this, but he didn't anticipate a very unusual thing that happens, which is when all those poisonous snakes converge on Bhima and begin to bite him, the poison that they put into his system acts as an antidote to the poison that's already in his system. So the food poisoning and the snake poisoning counteract each other, and Bhima suddenly becomes awake and is very strong and begins to fight with all the snake warriors, and they run away to their king, and they say, this great warrior is here, and the king suspects who it might be and is very impressed and comes to him, and he takes Bhima to his royal palace. How we sort of deal with all of this underwater, we don't really sort of work on this small issue. Somehow, magically, all this happens. But the snake king is so delighted to have this great warrior that he's heard about with him, that he feeds him and feasts him. And he says, more than that, he said, I have here a magic elixir. Clearly you have enemies and will need strength. He said, drink as much of this elixir as you can down, and it will give you the strength not only of what you already possess, but the strength of all the snake warriors will be in you too. So Bhima drinks this elixir, and then he proceeds to fall asleep and sleeps for almost 8 days. Now in the meantime, the festivities in the forest are over, and the entourage is all gathering itself up and heading back where they're going, back to Hastinapura, and everybody looks around, and they can't find Bhima, and nobody seems to know where Bhima is. So, I mean, he's a competent, capable person, and people just assume he's gone back ahead of time. But they get back to the palace, and he's still not there. Now, Kunti begins to suspect that something terrible has happened and that Duryodhana is at the bottom, and she goes to Vidura to express her fears. But Vidura, who always has this wise perspective, and he has the gift of knowing what is coming in the future, but he also knows how to advise. In other words, to act now would not be wise. So he says to Kunti, don't act on your suspicions. Just leave it for the moment. And then Vidura says, have no fear. All your sons will live long and healthy lives. So time passes. And then, and Duryodhana, you know, acts as if he's grieved and concerned. But time passes and the days pass and Bhima wakes up and he comes out of the river and he goes back to the palace and he shows up there again. And Duryodhana has to act as if he's so glad to see him, but he's enraged that his plot has been foiled. And Bhima, advised by his mother what Vidura has advised them, says only to his family does he speak of what really happened. But now the enmity is really out in the open, and the Pandavas know what the lengths that Duryodhana will go to hurt them, and Duryodhana knows that the Pandavas know. But everyone has to just act as if everything is going on as they ought to. But they knew they had to be very careful. So Duryodhana begins to plot with his evil uncle Shakuni, because his idea hasn't worked, and now his uncle is going to get into the act. And in the meantime, we have a character now who is also very important to the story, and his name is Drona, and another character whose name is Drupada, and I'll explain them both to you. Drona was a great archer, and a teacher of archery, and a teacher of the arts of war. And Drona's quality is that he represents the habits of the past, what we call samskars. Samskars are those inclinations imprinted upon the chakras and imprinted upon the subconscious as the result of all of our past actions. So Drona represents our habits and our past habits sort of acting on us and compelling us forward in the present. And another character right now is Drupada. And Drupada's quality is dispassion, a disinclination for material things. And Drupada was a king, and when he was a young man, still just a prince, his father wanted him to be trained in the right way. And Drona is a Brahmin, and Drona's father was a Brahmin teacher, and Drupada came and lived in their home and was trained by his Brahmin father in the ways of righteousness and of the Vedas and so on like that. Now the Brahmins were poor, and Drupada's family as kings were very, very well to do. The Brahmins were considered a higher caste in terms of refinement and so on. And the two boys lived very simply, because kings often thought it was good for their sons to be raised up in simple circumstances. Drona and Drupada were of the same age, and they lived together in Drona's father's house, a very simple life together, and became best of friends. And in their youthful exuberance for one another, they promised that they would always be friends, that they were true brothers, and whatever they had, they would share it equally. And Drupada said, even when I come into my inheritance in the kingdom, when I become king, half of my inheritance will belong to you. So time passed, and Drupada did go off and inherit the kingdom, and Drona grew up to be a man also and tried to find his way as a Brahman. He had a wife, he had a son whose name was Aswatthama. And Aswatthama is latent desires, the seeds of desire. The offspring of past samskars is to create more seeds of desire. And that's what Aswatthama represents. Later on in the story, much later in the story, Aswatthama is declared to be one of the immortals. Aswatthama never dies, even though his side is defeated, because the latent desires never end, is what it is. That's what the image is. The seeds of karma just go on and on, because each one brings another, and they self-replicate forever, so he's considered to be immortal for that reason. So Drona was very poor. No, first Drona made a resolve within himself that he wanted to become the best archer in the entire world. And there was a great teacher of archery named Bhargava. And Bhargava did not like Kshatriyas, but he loved Brahmins. And so if you were a Brahmin and you wanted to train, you could go to Bhargava, and he would teach you how to be an archer. So Drona went away and left his wife and child, and for a long time trained with Bhargava, until in fact Drona did become the best archer in the world. And then he went back to his home, but he found that in the meantime his wife and son had fallen on ill luck and were profoundly impoverished. And here Drona had all this power as an archer, and he knew all the mantras and the astras and all these different things, but still he had no money, he had no job, he had no prospects. And then he remembered the promise that his boyhood friend, Drupada, had given him, and the loyalty that they had pledged to one another, and that Drupada had promised that he would share half the kingdom with them. So Drona said, well, to his wife and to his son, this is not a problem. I'll go to my friend and I will claim what he has promised me. So Drona went to Drupada and said, you know, here I am, a poor Brahmin, and you promised me half your kingdom. And Drupada said, what could you possibly have been thinking? We were just boys. Whatever makes you think that I would keep a ridiculous promise like that? Drupada was now proud of his position, and he just couldn't understand why. And he mocked Drona. You're just a Brahmin. Why would you be asking for these things? This is mine by right. It doesn't belong to you. What a foolish request. How could you be so naive? And Drona was silent but enraged. And he left without saying a word, but he had this determination in his heart that he would get his revenge. Now, what the symbology we're talking about here is that Drupada, you know, is this dispassion, this spiritually inclined force. And at the beginning, often, of our spiritual lives, our past habits seem to cooperate with us. We seem to be friends. It looks like we're going to be able to do this together. That's what happens when you first get on the path. It's not only that you have the energy of doing it in the moment, but you have this sensation that, you know, all of your past is helping you. And it is, because if you didn't have samskaras towards the spiritual path, you wouldn't be able to get on the spiritual path. But the problem is that we have lots of different samskaras. And so as long as those samskaras, as long as Drona and Drupada were working together for a common goal, which was their training as youth and so on, there was a sense of sharing it. But as soon as those samskaras turn materialistic, then Drupada has to repudiate them. He has to drive them out. He has to mock them. He has to tell them, what could you have been thinking? I am now the king. I am now, you know, dispassion is now in command of this kingdom. And if you think, just because you used to be my friend, but now you're no longer my friend because now your desires are materialistic. So Drupada drives him away. So Drupada realizes that his wife's brother has a position with the in the household in Hastinapurna, in Hastinapura, in the royal household. So Drona thinks, I can go there and I can get a position because I have all this tremendous skill and they have all these princes to train. And besides, I know Bhishma and Bhishma knows who I am. So he's on his way to Hastinapura and he happens to see, he sort of spies from behind a tree that the Pandavas are there and that they're playing a game and they have a ball. But the ball goes into a well, and they're just totally bewildered. They don't know how to get the ball out of the well. And so Drona comes, and he sees their dilemma, and he says, here's what I'll do. And he takes a very valuable ring, and he drops it so that it falls right on top of the ball. And then he takes an arrow, and he shoots it in, and the ring keeps the arrow from penetrating too far into the ball, but just far enough. And then he shoots a series of arrows, each one of which penetrates the arrow ahead of it until he has a ribbon of arrows. And then he pulls the ball out, retrieves his ring. And they say, what an extraordinary feat of accomplishment. Who are you? And he says, go to your grandfather Bhishma and tell him what you have seen, and he'll know who I am. So they go and tell Bhishma, and Bhishma realizes who's there and comes to him and invites him. And when he hears Drona's offer to train these boys, Bhishma's overjoyed. He said, my palace is overrun with young men who need to be trained in the arts of war. You know, you would be serving us beyond my capacity to repay you if you would train them. So Drona brings his wife and his son, and he also tells Bhishma, he said, I'm going to do this for you, but there will come a point. I have a job that I need trained archers to take care of. And so the day will come when I'll ask for the payment for the services I'm giving you. And so Bhishma agrees. And that payment, of course, is that he has the desire to get revenge on Drupada. He's just biding his time until he can. So the Pandavas all begin to study archery, and so did the Kauravas, Duryodhana, and all the brothers. But Arjuna, it quickly becomes clear, is the prize student. He just has this capacity to follow in Drona's footsteps that no one else has. Plus, his decorum, his high standards, his self-control, his spiritual nature is all very attractive to Drona, because Drona is our samskaras, and some of them are spiritual and some of them are not. And he, Drona, does his utmost to persuade his son, Aswatthama, the seeds of latent karma, to link himself with Arjuna, link yourself with self-control and self-mastery. But Aswatthama is just totally drawn to Duryodhana. The latent seeds of karma in him take him to material desire instead of to self-mastery, and there's nothing that Drona can do about it. It's past the offspring of past habits. Some of them are materialistically inclined. So then time passes and they develop their skill in this way. Now, let's go to another part of the story. You may remember that before Kunti had the five Pandavas, she had another son. In fact, that was how she got the mantra that she was later able to use with her husband Pandu. She was given it when she was just a young girl and very naively tried it out and accidentally brought to her the sun god, and the power of the mantra had to be fulfilled. So she had this son, and he was born with golden earrings and a golden breastplate. And this was the source of his great power. And by this, she always knew she would recognize him wherever he was. But she couldn't keep him. She was too frightened for herself to have her family know that she'd had this child, because she was an unmarried maiden and she just didn't know how she could explain it. So remember, she wrapped him up and put him in a basket and put him on the river. Well, that young man grows up and he has two names. One is Karna, which is the name I'll use mostly. And he's also called Radheya, because his foster mother, as it turns out, is named Radha. And in honor of his foster mother, he calls himself Radheya. Now, the quality, Karna, that we're going to talk about now, is the quality of the desire for happiness in this world. It's an extremely subtle and very complicated quality. And Karna becomes one of the most compelling, sort of heroic, tragic characters in the whole story, because there is something so heroic and tragic about this desire to be happy in this world. There's another quality that Master describes about Karna, which makes it even more subtle, which is that Karna is the inclination in ourselves to be attached to things that give us pleasure, and then to justify it by calling it our duty. Now, that's sort of a little snippet in there, like, you know, people will say, well, it's not really that I really need to live in such a big house, but my wife really likes it. Of course, I would spend more time in meditation, but I have to take care of my parents, and so I need to do this. It's not really I who care about earning all this money, but it's the family business, and I need to do it for everyone. And just all these different ways in which we're not really doing what we say we're doing. We're justifying ourselves because it's what we want. And so Karna has that sort of tragic flaw to follow his duty, but his duty also is something that he wants, and he's very drawn, as you'll see, to Duryodhana. So what happens is, as a little child, he was found, as you recall, by Radha and her husband, and he was raised in very humble circumstances. His father's a chariot driver. Their caste is called Sudaputa, which means the cross between a kshatriya and a Brahmin. So it's his 16th birthday, Karna, and he's a magnificent man, you know, much bigger and different looking than his family. And because he's coming into his manhood, his father assumes that he will follow in his profession, because in those times, it was a very harmonious times. That's just the way it was. And his father wanted to provide a chariot for him and he could become a driver. But Karna is very distressed inside himself, because he has this overwhelming desire to follow the art of a kshatriya, to become, especially to learn archery and to become a warrior. And finally, in his dilemma, he is talking to his mother, and his mother said, you know, what is it that is so disturbing to you this day? He said, I have this unreasonable desire to become a kshatriya, to learn the art of archery, and it makes no sense. Here I am born in this situation, and father wants me to follow in his footsteps, and I don't feel that I can do this. Now Radha begins to cry. His mother begins to cry. And she's never told him about his origin or his birth, because she's loved him so much, she's just wanted him to really be her own son. So she says that she realizes that she finally has to tell him. And before she does, she says, Radha says, often in your sleep, my son, I have heard you talking. I've heard you say, who are you? Where do you come from? Why are you here? And your voice is so filled with longing and anguish. His mother says, why? What is it that is happening in your sleep? So Karna describes this recurring dream that he has, where a woman comes to him, and he's sleeping, and he sees the woman bending over him. And he can almost see her, but her face is covered with a cloth. And he can see by the ornament she's wearing and by the cloth that covers her that she's a person of wealth and position. And she just leans over, and he feels this tremendous sadness coming from her, and also love, but also sadness. And he feels all this longing to relate to her. So Karna has this great longing to be with this woman, and he says to her in his dream, or he says in his own consciousness in this dream, he says, who are you? Why are you here? Tell me your name. Reveal your face to me. And all she does is weep. But then she disappears when he calls to her. So when his mother, Radeha, hears this dream, she realizes that she really must tell her son what is happening. So she says, my son, the experience you're having in that dream is a true dream. And then she tells him, when you were not born to me, although you could not be more my son than if I had carried you in my own womb. But your father, in fact, found you in a basket on the river, and clearly you are the child of some high-born woman who perhaps conceived you in a way that she could not keep you, and therefore she put you in the river. And I always felt, Radha says to her son Karna, that you were a gift from God to me. But it is no wonder that you don't feel to follow the destiny of your father, because no doubt your father is some high-born person. So Karna is both distressed and relieved. It breaks his heart to realize that he's not really the son of his own mother. But at the same time, it frees him, because now he realizes that the desires he feels within him are righteous desires, and that it is not meant that he should live this life, but he was destined for something else. And he falls at the feet of his mother, and he says, you know, whatever happens in this world, I will always be known as Radha's son, Radeha, Radha's son. And that woman, whoever she may be, she did not love me. She gave me away. She was more concerned about herself than me. You are my true mother. And he says, I now must go out in quest of my destiny, but you will always be my own. So he goes out and he tries to find a way to follow his desire to become a great Kshatriya archer. And he goes to Drona and he tries to get Drona to train him. But Drona says, you're a Sudaputra. You're a low caste person. I absolutely cannot train you. But then he says then he tries other teachers, and none will take him because of his caste. And he finally decides, well, he'll go to Bhargava, this great and famous guru of archery, because Bhargava doesn't like Kshatriya, so he doesn't need to be a Kshatriya. And inasmuch as his caste is a combination of Brahmin and Kshatriya, Karna makes the decision that he will say he is a Brahmin, because that way he will be able to be trained. So his desire to have what he wants in this world causes him to not exactly lie, but to bend the truth in order to move things, to bring them about in his way. This is when we have desires for things to come out our way, we're not always entirely honorable. So Bhargava takes him, because clearly he's a prince among men. He's a magnificent man. And so for many years, Karna works and gives his all to his training. And he's Bhargava's star pupil. He learns all the skill of archery. He learns the mantras. He learns the astras. He learns everything he needs to know to be a great world-conquering warrior. And he's thrilled, because now things are really finally coming to be in the way he wants them to be. And his guru says to him, you know, you are my prized pupil. You are honorable. You are honest. You are true. You are brave. And he lists all his qualities. And then they're out in the forest together, and Bhargava is tired. He wants to take a rest. And he wants to lie down, and he asks Karna to bring him a pillow. And Karna says, no, just put your head on my lap, my guru. It would be my pleasure to be your pillow. So Bhargava lies down to go to sleep. And while he's resting, Karna is thinking about all the praise that his guru has lavished upon him. And he's uneasy because he knows that even though he's been utterly honest since that time, in order to get Bhargava to take him as a disciple, he had to tell an untruth. So while he's sitting there, a burrowing insect lands on Karna's leg and begins to grind its way into his leg, and it creates tremendous pain and a flow of blood. But for Karna to remove the insect or to stand and extricate himself from the situation, he would have to disturb his guru. So he has the power within him just to endure this terrible discomfort, and the blood keeps flowing, and finally so much blood is flowing that some of it falls on Bhargava, and it awakens Bhargava, and he turns and he looks and he sees what's happened. And an intuition, an intuitive thought comes to Bhargava, and he says, no Brahmin would have the courage to endure pain like that. There's no possibility that you are in fact a Brahmin. You must be a Kshatriya. Now, Radha Karna realizes, you know, that he's been found out, and he falls at his guru's feet and he explains to him that he did in fact tell him an untruth, and he says, I don't know who I am. I am of the son of some unknown woman, but it is presumed that my lineage is as a Kshatriya, but no, I am not a Brahmin. And so Bhargava, who is this rishis, they have these terrible tempers, he becomes very angry at Karna, and he says, I have already given you the training, I can't take it back, but I curse you that in the moment when you most want, in the face of your most important foe, at the time that you need it the most, your mind will become clouded and you will not be able to remember the mantras that I have taught you. And oh, Karna is so defeated, and Bhargava sends him out. And so Karna goes off, and he's wandering by the sea, and he's sort of in a daze. All his efforts to have things come out just the way he wants them have suddenly met with this horrible ending. And he sort of sees an animal by the sea, and he shoots it, and it dies. And he goes up to it, and to his horror, he realizes that he thought it was a wild animal, but in fact it's a domesticated cow. And not only is it a cow, but it belongs to one of the rishis there. And that rishi also becomes angry at him and says, you who are such a great warrior, he said, shooting this animal when it was utterly defenseless, when it had no intention of harming you, when it was not an allowed animal for you to shoot because it was my own pet, and helplessly it lay there and you took its life. He said, that same will happen to you. He said, your chariot in the critical moment, you will find your wheel will become stuck in the mud, and just as helplessly as that animal was lying there when you killed it, you will be helplessly struck down by your foe. Now all Karna can say is, well, the fates are against me. And what more can be done? He just says, I'll live my life as best I can and let fate take its course. So he went to visit his mother and then decided that he would seek his fortune at the greatest court in the land, which is Hastinapura. So now what's going on in Hastinapura is that Drona has trained all these young men in the arts of war, and he decides that it's time for them to demonstrate everything that they know, all their great prowess. And they set up this great hall, and they invite all the people in the land to come. And Drona is going to have an extraordinary tournament where they're going to display all their different skills with the mace, with the sword, and their skill in archery. And in the back of Drona's mind, he's really setting up this tournament for one reason, which is he wants to show off his prize pupil, Arjuna. He has a teacher's natural pride in what this student of his has been able to accomplish. So the high point of the whole competition is going to be a demonstration by Arjuna, which no one will be able to match, of his extraordinary skill as an archer. And so the day begins, and the princes all file in, and Yudhishthira is in the lead because he's the eldest. And the first demonstration is going to be between Bhima and Duryodhana, and they're both been trained in the mace. In fact, Duryodhana has also been trained by Krishna's brother, Balarama. Balarama is one of the most famous wielders of the mace in the whole country. And you have this other sort of play that goes, which is Krishna, of course, is always with Arjuna, but Balarama, his own brother, has an inclination to side with Duryodhana. I can't explain to you why that would be, but that's the way it is. Now, the two, Bhima and Duryodhana, this is supposed to be, you know, merely a professional athletic competition, but there's so much personal between them that it's very hard for them to remain merely impersonally demonstrating their strength. And as the battle continues, it becomes more and more personal and more heated, and people in the audience begin to take sides, and finally, it's just really too much. And Drona sees that this combat must be stopped, and so he sends his son Aswatthama in to separate them. And it's very difficult, but reluctantly they're persuaded to put down their weapons and to step aside. And various other events take place. And then finally, it's time for Arjuna. And Drona so proudly sends him forward, and the whole crowd is on their feet because Arjuna is not only talented and kind, but he's handsome, and he just radiates with all the kind of charisma that would make a monarch, a prince, popular. And Dhritarashtra has to deal with his jealousy because the crowds do not cheer for his own son like that. Duryodhana is attractive and has magnetism, but not like Arjuna. There's no magnetism like the power of self-control. Duryodhana has the power of indulgence, but Arjuna has the power of self-mastery, so he is much more magnetic. So Arjuna does all of the great feats that Drona set up for him to do, and everyone is just, they can't believe that a human being could be so powerful. And then just at the moment of triumph for Arjuna, there's a noise off to the side, and a person no one has ever seen before enters in, and he comes in with all the power of a prince, and he actually overshadows the Pandavas and Arjuna and everyone, and of course it's Karna, and he's come to compete in the tournament. And he salutes Drona, and he says to him, you know, can anyone compete? And Drona, of course, can't say no. His honor is at stake. He has to allow everyone. So Karna just walks in, and he just does every single thing that Arjuna just did. No one, they thought, was capable of doing it, but he does everything that Arjuna did. And the crowd just goes wild, because not only do we have one champion, but now we have two. And then Karna turns to Arjuna and he challenges him to single combat. You know, let us pit ourselves one against another. And Karna is the son of the sun, and Arjuna is the son of Indra, who's also the god of rain. So as this challenge is issued, a beam of sunlight comes down and illuminates Karna, and this dark cloud hovers over Arjuna and sends a protective shadow over him. And they're just about to go into battle when suddenly there's a commotion over in the section where the women are, and Kunti falls down in a dead faint because she's looking here and she realizes that this is the child that she gave away. He's wearing his golden shield and his golden earrings. Besides, a mother always knows her son. And she's just doesn't know what to do, and Vidura rushes to her and he says to her, it's not time to speak. But from that moment, Kunti knows no peace, because now she sees her son and she sees what is going to happen. So Karna and Arjuna are about to have this fight when suddenly the referee, Kripa, says, we're only allowed to fight among equals. It's one of the laws of the Kshatriyas. We can't have a superior being fighting against a lesser being. It would be an unequal combat. So he says to Karna, declare yourself. What is your lineage? Where do you come from? Of what caste are you? What right do you have to challenge this prince of Hastinapura? And of course, this is Karna's tragic reality, because he doesn't know who he is, and the only life that he knows does not qualify him to challenge Arjuna, even though he knows he's competent and capable of doing so. And he stands silently with his head down. Then Duryodhana, seeing suddenly someone capable of fighting against the Pandavas and realizing what the implications of this are, and also because he has a generous heart. You know, sometimes people who are very materialistic are very generous. They have a lavishness about them. It's not necessarily that they're small or little in their awareness. They may live very large. He goes up to Karna and he says, what difference does it make, he says to the crowd, what this man's parentage is or where he comes from. There is no doubt when you look upon him, this is a king. And then Duryodhana says, the throne of the kingdom of Anga is sitting empty. He said, right now I confer that kingdom upon you. And then he calls for the proper implements and the priest to come, and they have a coronation ceremony, and right on the spot, Karna becomes the king. And Karna has never, no one has ever responded to him in this way. And his desire to be happy in this world meets the desire for material things, and he gives his heart to Duryodhana, and he never takes it back. He gives it to him because Duryodhana reached out to him. Material desire promised him everything he was seeking and conferred upon him great riches. And so he gives his loyalty to that king forever after, which of course is his tragic undoing as time goes on. Now then, Karna has now become qualified to fight with Arjuna. And just again, when they're about to start, there's another commotion, and breaking through the ranks comes Karna's adopted parents, who have not seen him in a long time because he's been with Bhargava. He went off to seek his fortune. Suddenly, they're in the crowd of this great tournament, and this prince-like being walks in, and they realize it's their own son. And they can contain themselves no longer, and they rush forward. And they're clearly of low caste. And he has the implements and the marks of a chariot driver. But Karna, because he's loyal to those he loves, he doesn't pretend. He wouldn't have the heart to just ignore them and say, who are these people? He falls at their feet and he touches their feet with his head as an obedient son would and says, Father, Mother. And then Bhima begins to laugh, this mocking, derisive laughter, and he says, a king, look who he really is. These are his parents. He's nothing but a Sudaputra. He's the son of a chariot driver. What foolishness, what presumption to challenge Arjuna. And then he laughs and he puts his arm around Arjuna and they walk out of the hall. And then Duryodhana puts his arm around Karna and they walk out of the hall. And everybody's abuzz with what has happened. You know, Arjuna's moment of triumph has been spoiled by the advent of this stranger. And Yudhishthira is very disturbed because suddenly he sees that Duryodhana has an ally equal to Arjuna. And Yudhishthira has known that sooner or later this conflict would come to a head, and he's counted on the fact that Arjuna had no equal, but now he may have an equal. Self-mastery is fighting with the desire to have happiness in this world. You see, we go two ways. We either try to indulge our desires in this world, or we try to have self-control and master our desires in this world. And the two are mortal enemies. So, now Indra has witnessed this whole experience from his heavenly realm. And he's also very concerned because with his divine perspective, he can see, he knows who Karna is and he understands. He knows he's the eldest of the Pandavas and he knows what power is there. And he also knows that he was born with this gift from his father of this breastplate and these earrings, which are also the source of his enormous power. And Indra makes the decision that he's going to try to save his son Arjuna by weakening Surya's son, Karna. Now, every day at noon, Karna does a worship ceremony of the sun. He doesn't know that he was conceived by the power of the sun, the power of the sun being the power of the spiritual eye in this case, but by spiritual power. Kunti's name also means the power to invoke spiritual power. So she, by invoking the sun god, she invokes the power of the spiritual eye. But she did that, the way the story is, before she was married to Pandu, and Pandu is discrimination. So she invoked the spiritual power before she had the discrimination to know what to do with it. And that's how Karna's birth came about and was so flawed. So every day it is Karna's practice, exactly at noon when the sun is overhead, that he carries on this worship service. And he's also known for the fact that at the end of his worship service, whoever comes to him and asks of him a favor, a boon, they usually call it, asks of him a favor, then no matter what that favor is, he will grant it. It's his invariable rule, it's his absolute vow. And so people take advantage of his generosity in many different ways. So Indra decides that the next day, after his worship service, Indra is going to disguise himself and come and ask for a boon. Now Surya, who also, they all know what each other is plotting, so Surya comes to Karna in a dream that night And he says, a Brahmin is going to come to you and ask of you a favor. He says, whatever you do, do not grant that favor. That Brahmin does not wish you well. And even in the dream, Karna answers Surya and he says, I have vowed to grant whatever is asked of me after my worship service. My vow is more important to me than any other reality. Thank you for the warning, but I can't heed it. So the next day he finishes his worship, and Indra has disguised himself as a Brahmin, and he comes and he says, give to me your golden earrings and the breastplate. And these are attached to his body, and these are not ornaments that he wears. It means he has to amputate them from his body. Karna says, I know who you are. And because Surya had told him that this was going to be Indra in disguise, I know who you are and I know why you are asking this of me. Because without these golden ornaments, my power is diminished. With them I am invulnerable, but without them I can be defeated. And yet my vow, the dharma of my vow, is more important even than protecting myself, even than ensuring my own safety and well-being. So he just rips them off. And Indra, who has made the decision to do this and wants to do it for the sake of Arjuna, is still so overcome with the greatness of Karna's commitment to dharma, knowing that Karna knows what he's doing and what he's sacrificing. So Indra feels inspired. He has to give something back. So first he heals the wounds that were created by the removal of these ornaments from his body for the first time. And then he says, I'll grant you a boon. What would you like of me? And Karna asks for the weapon called the Shakti weapon, which is a powerful weapon that Indra has that Karna would like to have in his arsenal so that he can use it against Arjuna when the time comes. And Indra says that I can give it to you, but he says there's a condition of this weapon when it's given in this way, which is that it can only be used one time. And after that one use, it returns to me. You will never be able to summon it again. And so Karna says, that's fine, because I only have one enemy, and I only need it for one use. Indra says to Karna, he says, Karna, you must understand, Arjuna is protected by Krishna. You have no hope ever of defeating him. Not even my Shakti, Indra says, can touch him as long as Krishna is his protector. But then Indra says, he said, whether you are victorious or defeated in battle is a very small matter. The greatness of your name will live on because of your honor and because of your commitment to dharma. So then Karna is there with Indra and he says, perhaps you know who is my mother? Who is the woman who comes to me in my dreams? What is her name and where can she be found? And with immense sadness, Indra looks at Karna and he said, ah, that is a secret that I cannot tell you. So, that'll be as far as we go tonight.